Good afternoon. My name is Mark Bielan. I'm in the Geo Department here at Calvin College, which is Geology, Geography, and Environmental Studies, and I belong to the last two of those. I teach Geography and Environmental Studies. I'm fairly new to Calvin College and fairly new to Grand Rapids. I taught for 15 years at Gustavus Adolphus College in Minnesota, and I'm a native of Minneapolis, Minnesota. Come on in. And so welcome to this. I would love to get to know you, but we don't really have time for that. So I'm just going to jump in, and we're going to start talking about how mapping and visualizing congregations can help us understand congregational life and perhaps do a better job of fulfilling what Jesus entrusted us with here. And I just thought this image would start, these two images that are paired here, would kind of get us a little bit thinking about how there are different ways that congregations relate to communities. And here are two congregations from the same denomination, the Evangelical Covenant Church. They're in the same district of the Evangelical Covenant Church. And one of them is barely visible on this Google Street image. Barely visible. There it is. Notice the size of their parking lot. Has zero spaces, but it has a bike rack. And then here's another one on the right. Think about their community ministry, their outreach minister for that community. There's no houses visible. There are actually no houses visible anywhere near there. They have to go a couple miles to the nearest house. So you have these different kinds of settings, neighborhood settings in which a congregation is called to do Christ's work, to be Christ's community. And I want to think about how mapping can help us think about that so that we can do a better job. So, I want to start with some really kind of esoteric points and then kind of come down to earth, so to speak. Well, the great philosopher Martin Heidegger says that to be is to be in place, to have presence. So it's what it means to be human, is to be in a particular place. Or even further back, Archytas of Tarentum said, to be is to be in some place. It's part of being human is that we are placed here on this earth which God has created. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt.
No.
If we email you, can we have these slides?
Yeah, I'm going to have to shrink it. It was actually kind of large. And, okay. But yeah, I'd love to do that. Yeah, come on in and grab a blank sheet of paper and the handout. A little bit more on the practical side, one of my geography colleagues, Bob Sachs, said that we humans are geographical beings. His book is called Homo Geographicus. Part of what it means to be human is to make our home here on this earth, to transform this earth and make it our home, our habitat. The earth is the human habitat. And we have transformed that earth in massive ways. That's the environmental studies part of my background. But that transformed earth affects who we are. When we meet somebody, I always want to know where they're from, because that where they're from shapes who they are. You know, so that transformed earth shapes who we are. Shifting a little bit more towards kind of Christian theology, the Lord God planted a garden toward the east in Eden, and there he placed, and that's the word I want to emphasize and should have had in italics, he placed the human, the earth creature who came from the earth. He placed us, and God has placed us in specific locations where we are to be the church, where we are to reflect the image of God. Place, according to Reformed theologian Craig Bartholomew, place is a constituent part of God's good creation. Think about the themes of place in the Bible. The theme of being into the promised land. The theme of exile, when the Israelites disobey, they lose their place. They're displaced. And the Bible goes back and forth between the good place, the Garden of Eden, being cast out of the Garden of Eden, going into the promised land, and then being displaced, going through exile, the time in Egypt, and so forth. There are all kinds of place themes in the scriptures. So place is a constituent part of God's good creation that he is already renewing and will finally renew at the end of the ages. Look at the place symbolism in Revelation, at the end of the book of Revelation. You know, it's rich with place themes. So it's one of the gifts of God to us is his good earth and placing us on this earth in specific locations. That image, by the way, is the Garden of Eden in New York City. It was a garden that was created in the 1970s when the Lower East Side was really, really bombed out. And a gardener tried to create this Garden of Eden in that space. Here's some more kind of place themes. And I like the Message translation. I was fortunate enough to go to Regent College in Vancouver when Eugene Peterson was there. And Eugene Peterson, who translated the scriptures into the Message, He writes here, he translates here, John 1:14. The Word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood. I just really love that. Moved into the neighborhood. Moved into the neighborhood. This artist who happens to be my wife has done this painting of Christ moving into the neighborhood. And she set it on a street scene, because Christ moved into the neighborhood. The incarnation is about being in place, not sort of this, virtual communication between heaven and earth, but being incarnated in place. So place matters. Notice in a lot of the epistles that it's addressed to the saints in, fill in the blank, to the churches in Galatia, to the saints gathered in Ephesus, and so on, in a particular place. And then this is something interesting, and a lot of you are probably much more theologically astute than I am, but I was just thinking about this today. These, I think, are Jesus' last words, recorded at least in the scriptures. You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, and in all Judea, and Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. And what happens next? He's taken up to heaven. So at least as Acts gives us the account, these are Jesus' last words. As a geographer, I'm getting really excited. Earth was, according to the English translation, earth is the last word that Jesus spoke before going to heaven. But anyway, this is a very geographical framework here for what the church is called to do, to be Christ's witnesses in Jerusalem. And I understand that is the place where we are. And in Judea, this broader region, Samaria, the place where we have cross-cultural issues, perhaps, and to the ends of the earth. This geographical framework for what Christ's church is called to do. That gets me excited. Well, Protestants don't have, I have a really complicated church background, so I won't go into that. But it includes Lutheran, Episcopalian, Vineyard, and now Christian Reformed, and Evangelical Covenant as well. But I've noticed that in churches, Protestant churches that don't have a parish tradition like you have in the Roman Catholic Church, like you have in the Anglican Church, but Baptists, Covenanters, people that don't have a parish tradition are rediscovering the parish. Rediscovering neighborhood and place. Megachurch pastors are writing books like The Externally Focused Church, The Externally Focused Quest. Those are written by Rick Rousseau and Eric Swanson, who are Denver area megachurch pastors, and they are talking about becoming the best church for the community. They're rediscovering their place. And in a lot of ways, megachurches are kind of, in some sense, regional, not local, but they're rediscovering their place. And these other two books, the top two ones, are real recent books, and they're written by people that come out of evangelical Protestant traditions that don't have a large emphasis on place and community and parish, and yet they're rediscovering the new parish and so on, and living, kind of realizing the importance of connecting with their parish community, even if they don't have an official parish boundary. So as I talk today, I want to just throw out three geographic concepts that I think are really useful, and they are deceptively simple because they are five-letter words, they are one syllable, and we use them every day. Space, place, and scale. I got them in different order. Sorry about that. Space, place, and scale, but they're really powerful concepts that we can use in all kinds of ways in our life. When I say space, I'm not talking about NASA. I have to get this across to my students. When I'm talking about space as a geographer, what I'm talking about is location and the things that go along with location. So things that go along with location are patterns. Like when if I'm a criminologist, I might map the crimes. What is the pattern? Are they clustered? Are they dispersed? I might look at things, I don't have it on there, but associations. I might look at the locations of Zika virus cases and Aedes mosquitoes. And I might look at the associations between the two. And one of the things I throw at my students in the first class is a map of Baptists in Texas and a map of townships that are dry, where you can't buy alcohol. And there's a strong spatial association. That's spatial thinking about how locations are related or how locations are moving and changing over time, how they're clustered or dispersed and so on. So that's what we mean when we say spatial thinking or space. Place is another super deceptive concept. To be is to be in place. But the concept of place is actually quite powerful. What a place is, as geographers think about it, is it's a location. It has a coordinates. It has an address, okay? And that address has a material setting. It has bricks, and it has trees, and it has grass, and it has a social setting of people and different groups and ethnic groups and racial groups that come together in that place, and it has an emotional content. Some people call that emotional content a sense of place. So a place, when I asked you, if I had the time to ask you, where are you from, you might tell me the address or the name of the city, but you're going to have emotional attachments to that, either good or bad. It might be a place of fear. It might be a place of deep attachment and love and emotional content. So a sense of place has this emotional content that space doesn't have. This could be just latitudes and longitudes, whereas this has meaning to it. Place has meaning to it. And then scale comes from mapping, which we geographers just do way too much of. We just love maps. But maps come in different scales. Some maps show the whole world, and then the one to the left of that map on the wall shows just the Holy Land. So those maps are at different scales. And there'll be a little bar on the bottom of that map that tells you the scale, the relationship between how big things are on the map. There'll be a thing over here that shows me 20 miles is that distance there. So the relationship between what's on the map and the real world dimension of that object, okay? That's the scale of the map. But the scale of the map tells me how much detail I can see. On this map, I can see cities and rivers and mountains and all kinds of detail in the Holy Land that I can't see on this global map. And so to think geographically is to think back and forth across scales, because I can see really good things here on that local scale map, but I don't get the big picture. And here I can get the big picture, but I miss the fine detail. And that is really, really important, is to kind of move back and forth between the local, regional, and global scales. So that scale is the zoom of our map and is really important. All right, so now I'm going to talk about spatial thinking. It's just some mapping that we can do with spatial thinking. A lot of churches have something like this. How many of you have churches where you have a pushpin map of where the members of the congregation live? It's really cool. I love that. I like that idea. I got that idea. And this is just one we did in a computer mapping program for a church in Minneapolis. But it's really interesting to do this. The green dots are the household church members, households of the church members, and there's the church. And you can learn something from doing that. And it's really valuable. I encourage you to do that. As you think spatially about it, you can go further than that. You can ask the question, how do people get to church? How far do they live, but how do they get there? Do they use transit? Do they bike? I think it's really interesting is how a lot of churches don't even have a bike rack. You know, I'm a bike commuter, by the way. But how do they get to church? Do they use the bus? A lot of the old urban churches were on street or close to street core intersections, and they don't even have parking lots because they didn't need parking lots because everyone took the streetcars. Now those churches are 100 years removed from that era, and how do they adapt? How far do people travel to church? Is there a difference in the travel distances for newcomers and old-timers? I did this for a congregation, and it was absolutely fascinating. It was a Lutheran church in South Minneapolis, and they had an English service for the old-timers, and then they started a Spanish service, and that attracted a whole bunch of newcomers. About an equal population. The geographies of those two congregations couldn't be more different. Does anyone want to guess what I saw when I mapped those two for them?
The old-timers were their way.
Yeah, the old-timers were commuting probably an average around 5 miles, and the newcomers were in walking distance. That is really interesting. I think every church should do this. They should compare these things and see what's going on. Or another thing, I'm at a church in Grand Rapids here, and I would ask the question, what about the age distribution? What about the young families? Where are they living versus the seniors in the congregation? Is there a difference there? In my particular church in Grand Rapids, there is a difference. The young families are kind of part of this gentrification wave moving back into the center city, whereas the senior members of the congregation are out in the suburbs, and a lot of them are out at retirement communities or townhome developments out in the suburbs. So we have different geographies for different parts of our own congregation. So in other words, we should go back to this map and color code it with newcomers or different groups. It's just interesting there. A lot of churches have this as well. If they're in an inner city location where they have an active youth ministry, they would have a youth ministry that focuses on the local area because kids are constrained by distance more than adults are. And the adults have long commutes, but the youth program tends to be more localized in some cases. I've seen that. Okay, so that's something you could ask. How local is your congregation? Here are two congregations in the same neighborhood of South Minneapolis. And this is a graph that looks sort of scientific. It's a distance decay graph. It's just the percentage of the members that have a commute farther than that specified distance. So everyone is 100% is greater than a distance of zero. But what's interesting is look at the 50% mark. For the traditional Lutheran congregation, it's about 2 kilometers is the halfway commute. For the there is this in Minneapolis, a Norwegian language Lutheran church, where they hire the pastor from Norway, and they have services. I think everyone drives Volvos and wears clogs. All the men wear clogs. But they have their services in Norwegian still to this day, you know, 2016. And it's the Mindekirke, Norske Mindekirke. And look at that. It's about 12 kilometers is the midpoint commute. They and another thing I did in with this analysis, and I'm looking for chalk, is I took a map of Minneapolis. Minneapolis is sort of a boring square. And I had all the Lutheran churches. And what I did is I computed the areas closest to each one. You know, so kind of boundaries like this. Can you imagine what I'm doing? So you're getting the zone closest to each church, okay, in a computer program, mapping program. And then I had the map of who went to all the churches. I did this for the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. And I said, how many of their members are going to the Lutheran church closest to home? And for the traditional churches, it was pretty high. For those specialty niche churches like the Norwegian language Lutheran church, the answer was zero. They had nobody going to the church close to home. Nobody lived anywhere near the church. It was just interesting. But how does that affect the congregational life? That's the really interesting question that I won't answer for you, but I want you to think about that is, how does it affect congregational life if, let's say you had a neighborhood-based congregation where you're going to have your kids in the same school district, where you're going to see each other at the supermarket, where popping into church after work is really easy because it's right on your way, versus a church where you've got to go 10 miles out of your way and deal with traffic and all that to get there. How is that going to affect congregational life? You know, and discipleship and all those kinds of things. I think it has a profound effect. Yeah?
If I may.
Oh, yeah.
I plotted in Google Earth the membership of my congregation and the only other denominational same sister congregation in our city. And we could not, with statistical significance, figure out which church you went to based on where you lived. The map was just overlaid on both. So no matter where you lived within the city of Holland, you went to one of these two churches, but you couldn't figure out where based on where you lived.
So distance wasn't the important factor. It was probably the pastor or the specific programs and so on. And that's an interesting thing to find out. And that's interesting. But still, distance matters. Every church that I've done this for, and I've done this for about 20 churches, every church has an equation that looks like a distance decay graph. So those of you who have had physics and distance decay, distance still matters. It just matters less for specialty churches. But it still matters because distance costs you time and money. So distance matters, but if a church has a unique niche, you'll travel further. Yeah, I think that's an interesting finding. Thanks for sharing that. So another way you can think about this, just again, just thinking spatially here, is not just distance, but direction. These are 4 churches in Minneapolis. Do you see any directional differences? How does this affect congregational life? Isn't this interesting? Okay, so let's talk about the upper right one. Okay, I've got it listed, and you've got it on your handout too if you want to actually see. The upper right one is a high church. That is, this is a church with literally bells and smells. They do incense. They have really fancy robes. It's Gothic. It's Lutheran, but it seems very high church for Lutherans. Anyway, well, if you knew anything about Minneapolis, you'd know that the money in Minneapolis, the elites live in the southwest. That's where all the lakes are. And that's where they draw their people from. One side of town, the southwest side of town, not the other sides of town. So that's interesting that there's kind of a directional bias in the church, and it's where it draws its people from. Whereas the Norwegian congregation, kind of all over the place, aren't they? But just not close. Just not close. And the story there, the backstory is, the Norwegians, like a lot of European immigrant groups, were dirt poor when they came. They built their church in the poor immigrant entry neighborhood, and now that they're middle class and suburbanized, they don't live anywhere near there. So they're commuting from the four corners, and not close by, and not a local congregation. This is a Hispanic congregation that has a lot of members, but it just looks like a little blip on the map because they're all in walking distance. This is really interesting to me because it's as if they've recreated the Mexican, it's a Mexican-American congregation. They've recreated a kind of Roman Catholic parish civilization in South Minneapolis within walking distance. And it's really interesting, and that's a vibrant, fast-growing church. I just was back in Minneapolis last week, and it's bigger than it was before. You know, so it's, and that's interesting. That's going on in this world of automobiles and planes and trains and automobiles, but some congregations are going very, very local. I find that fascinating. And then another interesting thing, I did an Oromo Ethiopian Lutheran Church, which, by the way, is the fastest growing Lutheran church in the Evangelical Lutheran Church, as long as they stay in it. There's issues there. But anyway, the Oromo language church in South Minneapolis, they had actually the longest commutes of any group that I've ever mapped. And what's going on there? That's interesting. Well, what's going on there is a dying congregation founded by Swedes gifted their building to the Oromo group, the Ethiopian group, This, like a lot of new immigrant groups, are going straight to the suburbs. Minneapolis has lots of African immigrants, but they're largely suburban. You know, so they were gifted the building in the inner city. The idea was maybe this would be where their community would form a nucleus, but rather they were very suburban, and they went straight to the suburbs, you know. So it's just interesting things you can learn about communities. And a congregational life is going to be different because of this. This Ethiopian church, they do church kind of all Sunday. Or at least if you go there at 2 in the afternoon, they're still there. And so because they have to come from kind of far away, they make it worth their while. And they do church differently. They have a lot of food after churches, and they have long services. And it's worth your while to go to church because it's not just 55 minutes like a typical Lutheran church. It's, you know, you're there for much of the Sunday.
So would you consider all four of these niche churches?
Of these four, I would, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, that's a good point. And I'm just going to, I just think it's so interesting. Like, people don't want to cross downtown. There's a lot of traffic and issues. So people stay to their side of town, and generally, that's what I generally see. You see those interesting things. But the other kind of map I made here on the right is, this is a suburban megachurch, Evangelical Free. But a hotspot map, where this is just the density of members. So it's really interesting to kind of see where do you get your members, the density of those. And what I noticed interestingly here is that they don't really go into Minneapolis very much. This is the city limits of Minneapolis, and this is out in the suburbs. But they're not very effective at reaching people in the city. You can just see that in their pattern. So, you know, where are their hotspots? I think this is kind of fascinating stuff to do. Not just how far, but where are your hotspots and where are your cold spots in terms of your membership? Okay. Here is a map of the 55 Lutheran churches in Minneapolis, and this is on the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, 55 of them. But here what I've done is I've scaled the circle to be mathematically proportional to their average weekly attendance. Okay? What I found here blew my mind. What I found actually is that the two largest Lutheran churches gather 60% of the Lutherans who are going to church in Minneapolis on Sunday morning out of 55 churches. 60% are going to two of the churches. Okay. So it's very lopsided, the distribution. I don't know if other denominations are like that, but you got to map all of them to kind of see, do you have that pattern there? I also can see a kind of effect of sort of social class, social and economic status. So what I've done is I've put the housing prices underneath this. The highest housing price area, the most elite area, is in red. The kind of upper middle class or middle class areas are this peachy areas. And then the poorer neighborhoods are in the kind of paler colors. Okay? And so you have this really interesting phenomenon. There are two neighborhoods out of the 15 that are classified as kind of above average, but not the highest. And that's where the three most attended Lutheran churches happen to be. So that seems to be the sort of socioeconomic niche for those Lutheran churches that are most successful. But the majority of Lutheran churches, and there's a lot of little ones up in here, are actually in the poor neighborhoods, because that's where those Lutherans got their start back in the 1800s when they founded those churches. I think we'd find something similar with Christian Reformed churches in Grand Rapids today, but I'd love to do that, to think in terms of the whole system of churches. Anyway. Okay. All right. Another thing that you might want to do as a person in a congregation is try to understand your geographies of your communities, where you've got your people coming from, and what's in your community. And so rather than clicking on this hot link, I'm just going to go right to it. And this is something that we've built here at Calvin College. Let me just, well, just trust me. It's on your handout under the resources. It's under United States Perspectives, Understanding Your Geography. So it's at http://gis.calvin.edu if you want to find it, okay? And this is a fun little mapping thing that we've built here at Calvin that we thought we're just trying this stuff out. Maybe people will find this useful. So this is an, okay, you've got choices of layers. You can go with, like, U.S. population density. But what I like to do is this thing called the tapestry segmentation. This is market analysis of who are the people, you know, kind of what kind of people. And so if you look at this at the scale of the northeastern United States, it looks like Kent County is this upscaled avenue. But when you zoom in, when you change your scale, you see all these microgeographies of different neighborhoods, and you see different things. And
crazy. Where do you find this again?
It's on that site. We're using data from Esri, but it's called Understanding Your Geography. It's an app that we've built here at Calvin in the geography department. So if you want to click on, like, the neighborhood that we are in, it tells us that we are here in suburban splendor. Okay? And then if you want to read more, you can click on the full description to learn more about the market characteristics of the people who live in that area of suburban splendor. Okay? So what else do we have here? We have prosperous empty nesters over here to the kind of northeast part, probably the Grand Rapids Township, you know, and so on. And so you can learn about your community once you've mapped where your members are coming from or where they're not coming from, and so on. So understanding your geographies. Again, thinking spatially here, okay? So I encourage you to, you know, play around with this. It's a lot of fun. But back to work. all right. But now I want to shift from space to place, okay? And so I put this map on here, two maps. These were two maps that were created by geography researchers who asked children from the same family, asked them to draw a map of your neighborhood. Okay? What do you see differences, children from the same household, in their understanding, their sense of place? Okay? It's their life world that's been reflected on this map. What do you see different between the 6-year-old in this family and the 13-year-old?
The scale's different.
Yeah, they've changed scales.
Perspective and orientation.
Yeah. What is the world like from a 6-year-old? Having them draw a map can really give us some insights into their world and how they see the world. One of my students, who was from one of the suburbs here in Grand Rapids, he had his children's class draw their town. It was one of the suburban towns that's freestanding. And then he had their parents draw maps, and he compared them. And he had his kids at a Christian school, and he was very disappointed that his kids' maps had this game store where you get all these video game apps. And they had Target on there, and they had playgrounds, but they didn't have any churches on their map. Or the parents all had the church on their map. The church was on the map of the community. It's an essential part of the community, but hadn't been transmitted to the kids yet. Interesting. So you can see something about people's life worlds by looking at these maps, shifting from the abstractness of space to people's lived experience in place. Where do you think the author of this map is from? Okay, I'm hearing different voices. First, we thought it was Europe because Europe's big, But then we shifted over and people are saying North Africa. Why North Africa?
More detail.
Information and detail. Look at the Nile. Very detailed. Even the delta of the Nile. Look at Mesopotamia, or just look at the Tigris-Euphrates. Look at the detail. This was a Palestinian young person who drew this map. Look at Italy. The boot isn't really... And look at Australia and India. Shrunken in importance, okay? So you can tell from a person's sketch map something of their world and their understanding of the world that they inhabit. Here's the six-year-old's map. My house and my neighbor's houses in the backyard. The 10-year-old shifts to this abstract understanding of neighborhood. And the 13-year-old goes wider in the scale of their analysis. So the world changes. These are two kind of classic maps. They were drawn by African-American young persons who lived at the top of the map. The Mission Hill Project was a public housing project, but it didn't allow African-Americans. It was segregated, and it was a whites kind of only project. Okay? So looking at this and then comparing it with the real map, on this kid's map, one of the interesting, Ernest's map, is that this street, Parker Street, which is the divide between African-American and white Boston, it's exaggerated. This street is actually the same width as this street. But look at it, it's about five times as wide as the other street. So it's mentally a big barrier, so it gets drawn as a big street. Okay? This child doesn't exaggerate the size of the streets, but puts all the detail in his neighborhood, Dave's neighborhood, and not in the other neighborhood. That's kind of this blank place on the map, terra incognita, the other neighborhood. So think about your church trying to do outreach into a community. Do you have terra incognita on the mental maps of your congregants? I was embarrassed to tell you this, but I will. I go to church in the Baxter neighborhood, and I have for almost 3 years, 2.5 years, and one of my students was doing a project in a geography class about the Baxter neighborhood. She's African-American. She grew up there, and she had things on her map that I didn't even know, and she drew a map of this, and she had this store in the neighborhood, Tracy's, Miss Tracy's party store, and she said, this is the center of the community, and it wasn't on my mental map. Because my lack of experience in crossing some boundaries and stuff like that. So I felt kind of ashamed of that. So that's something that you can learn. And this is really powerful, I think, to kind of mapping, to try to get deeper into people's life world and their understanding of place. And so here are three different maps where large groups of people were asked, this is way back in the 1970s too, but this is a good technique to use. And so these are maps created from groups of people, not one person. And so what you do is you count the number of people that have some feature. Okay? And so if a lot of people have that feature, you make it thick. If only a few, you make it the line thin. Okay? So the bold features are the ones that are showing up on everybody's mental map. The light ones are only a few. Okay? So this was done by a group of white, upper-middle-class whites who live in the Westwood, kind of upscale neighborhood of Los Angeles, okay? Vast, expansive city that is at their fingertips, okay? Then in the upper right, you have Los Angeles through the eyes of black residents in the Avalon neighborhood, okay? Then at the bottom, Los Angeles through the eyes of Spanish-speaking residents in the Boyle Heights neighborhood. So we have different life worlds reflected in their mental maps that they've drawn, their sketch maps. And so you're doing ministry in these areas. This is really interesting stuff to have, information. What I think is most interesting about here, well, the freeway is the one that everyone has on their map, of course. But also there's kind of some blank zones. You know, this is the area that's rich on this map is kind of blank in here. And the area that's, think about, okay, let me situate myself. So you've got Union Station on this map in the lower right. On the Latino map, Union Station, it's not here on this map. Okay? And you've got all of this detail south of downtown here, south of the Civic Center, but it's just kind of blank on this white person's map. Interesting. The places we go and the places we don't go. We can learn a lot about, you know, how people are getting around the city, what they know, where they're afraid to go, all these things. Other geographers in London have done this thing where they've been attaching things to our heads that pick up our emotions. And then they're having people travel through the city of London and pick up where they feel fear and where they feel comfortable and good. Like, I don't know how you do this. But anyway, it's quite interesting. So you have a color-coded map of their emotions attached to different places. Again, really interesting. People are still doing this kind of research. It's not just back in the 70s, although that's when people were first doing this. But here's a map from some street children in Kampala in Uganda. And it was just fascinating to understand their world by asking them to draw a map. And the thing about this, if you ever look up this paper, which is in a geography journal, is that it's not just the map. The map's actually just a map. But the stories. So what they did with these street children in this research project, they said, tell me about your life and draw a map of the important places to you. And it's the stories that came out, that stories that didn't come out in the interviews but came out when they were drawing the map. Well, this is where we get food. If we go here, we can get some food on Thursdays or things like that. All this kind of information, the rich stuff that came out in the process of drawing it. Okay, so let me just jump along. I did a project in Vancouver, Canada, and in Minneapolis with pastors of different churches, evangelical churches. I'll back up. Where I asked pastors to draw a sketch map of the area where this congregation does its primary local ministry. Show the location of the church, important streets, landmarks, and other places that are important to the life of this congregation. Okay? And then I combined it with mapping where all their members lived. So I did the hot spot. This is the church in downtown Vancouver. There's the hot spot of their membership. This is a church that's trying to focus on the downtown. They've been a commuter church from the suburbs. But the new pastor says, we're going to focus on the downtown. We're not going to focus on the needs of the suburban commuters. And basically, it's a big financial decision because they've been renting this parking ramp for the suburban commuters. And they said, well, maybe we should focus on the people who are here. So they've made a decision to do that. And they hired a community pastor, and who was, when I did this interview, had been on the job for 2 years. Here was his mental map of the area that they were going to do their community outreach. Okay? And what he drew, and I'm sure he knows it a lot better today, but I'm just showing you how it takes time, because he was fairly new on the job, is he drew a whole bunch of high-rises. And in Vancouver, they're very skinny. And that's kind of just a typical Vancouver downtown scene, is it's a city of skinny high-rises downtown. And I think it was overwhelming to this church to how to do ministry in that setting, and so the map didn't have that detail. Compare that with just a few miles away, a neighborhood church. This is a church where that book about plunging into the kingdom, that book that I showed at the very beginning, this pastor, he drew this map, and the story was incredibly rich. I said, the same script, draw a map of the life of this congregation. And what he drew were the boundaries of what their parish was. This is a Baptist church. They don't have parishes, but he had a parish. He drew schools. He drew, and those X's are people, and he attached names as he was drawing this. He told me 23 residences of people in his church. It's this map. He knows where they live. It's on this street. They got this people, and then the Johnsons, and then the Smiths, and then the Kutkowskis. And he did that. He did all these things. And this is where the coffee shop where I prepare my sermons. This is the pub where we go after the Sunday night service. This is the restaurant where we go, you know, they go to things on Sunday. Anyway, and this is their church, and this is the Buddhist temple across the street. It was rich. He knew more about this neighborhood than I could imagine anyone in the world knew about that neighborhood. And he was about deeply rooted local ministry. And you could see this here. And this was the hot spot of their membership. As you can see, they don't really sprawl out in anywhere else. They're very focused on that place. Okay. Similar congregation in Minneapolis. Same kind of thing. The pastor drew this very detailed map of all these places that are important in the life of the congregation. These aren't just the stuff, but it's like, this is where we gather. This is where my people meet. This is where I run into them. This is where the private school where they send their kids to school, and so on. After church, we go to the Bridgman's ice cream parlor, you know, things like that. And sure enough, the hot spot, the red is the hot spot, right here, is where we were. So we transferred these locations to the real world. And that's sure enough. I mean, that's where that congregation was rooted. The places that are important to that congregation is right where their members are. And it was really remarkable. And it's a church that's doing quite well in a kind of gentrifying neighborhood of Minneapolis. Okay, So what I wanted you to do, just a moment, in me. All right, wrong tool. Is to take the sheet in front of you and draw a map of the congregational area, the area where your congregation does its ministry. Well, one of the things you might find out is that your congregation actually doesn't agree. Like my church talks about being a testimony of God's justice and love in the city. But what city are we talking about? We have this neighborhood engagement, and we've done this neighborhood discovery and neighborhood engagement and community outreach. But what community are we talking about? And we probably have maps that have very different scales because we're thinking different things. Some people might be thinking the metropolitan region, and other people are thinking like a two-block radius. And we're using the same word, neighborhood or city or community. That's one thing we could learn.
Do you go to Eastern?
No, but close to there.
First?
Sherman Street.
Sure.
Yeah, but my wife has taken a job at Fuller Avenue. So, and they have a community outreach minister. And the community outreach minister at Fuller Avenue, she has a map on her wall, but I couldn't show it to you because she has all the names of the people. She's trying to learn the names of all the people that live close to the church. So she's got their names and a little bit about them written in on. She had this really zoomed in Google Street Earth street map, and she's filled it in with information as she tries to learn the community, and so on. So how well does the congregation know and engage the neighborhood's hangouts, resources, problems, and other churches? Why am I interested in this? Well, a couple reasons, and I'm going to just go personal here for a moment. Both my wife and I grew up outside the church. So I was an unchurched kid, and my wife grew up, her dad was a philosophy professor at the University of Minnesota, who was proud to be an atheist and was proud to take away university students' faith, you know. And so, but my wife went to Minneapolis Central High School. Her older brother was in the same class as Prince. But she went to Minneapolis Central because it had an urban arts magnet program. So she didn't live in that neighborhood. But this church, it was a multiracial United Methodist church, had a very strong neighborhood vision. They saw themselves as ministering to a geographic community, even though they were Methodists. And they had a presence at Minneapolis Central High School. And they invited the youth from that high school to all kinds of functions. And my wife went on a bike trip that they did around Lake Superior, and she committed the ultimate act of rebellion in her household, which was to become a Christian. And she still is a Christian today. And for me, what it was is that my elementary school was across the street from a Lutheran church, that had an after-school program. And starting in fourth grade, my mom put me in that program as daycare because she was a single mom and it was free daycare. So that Lutheran church had adopted my neighborhood school. And then that youth group hired a youth minister whose job was half-time to pastor, in a sense, to the kids who didn't go to church, the unchurched kids in that geographic community. So here my wife and I are both Christians today because of churches that adopted the people in a geographic area. You know, so that's why I care about this. I'm not saying it's the only way to be a church. There's a place for regional churches and so on. But how do we get people into the kingdom? It's probably through relationships, and a lot of those are place-based. That's what I'm saying. And especially young people tend to be more limited in terms of their travels. So that's why I think it's important. Well, anyway, I'm going to shift scales because I only have a few minutes left, but I want to go a little bit global. And I think we have to, and this is something that geographers always remind ourselves of, is that place is really important, to have a sense of place. But you have to have a global sense of place. Because place can become the kind of thing that where you start to build walls. If you're all into your place and your sense of place, the Nazis had a very strong sense of place and territory, didn't they?
Yeah.
So place can be a bad thing, too, if it's not a place that's open and connected and recognizing a place's connections with other places. It needs to be a global sense of place. So this mapping thing can also be about connecting our local church to the global church and to the global mission of the church. And I am going to just show you some things that we're just playing with here in the geo department here at Calvin. One of my students created this as a prototype in his first mapping class that he took with me. And what he's doing, I guess we can show it to you live. Let's see. What he did is he created what's called a story map, where you have a map of the world, and then you have the Christian Reformed Church hymnal here, Lift Up Your Hearts. And what it does is he's got circles with the number of hymns from those different countries. He didn't bother doing the U.S. because that's old hat. So we've got the circles are sized based on the number of hymns in that hymnal from those countries. And then if you go down to South America, and then you have Brazil, these are the different countries that are in blue that we've got hymns from in that hymnal. And then you click here, and you have the hymn. So he wants to build this. So that if you want to do a hymn from Argentina, here's your map, click on it, here's the choices, and so on. I won't do it. Anyway, so that's just a student's project in his first mapping class. What is he going to do in the next class? I'm hoping. I'm excited. Here's another thing that we've built here, and the Joshua Project is a mission project to look at unreached peoples. Okay, so what they've, what we did for them, and actually this isn't me, this is Jason Van Horn, my colleague, is you have different layers that you can turn on, like about people groups or and so on. I'm just going to close that. But this is, and it allows you to move around the world and find out about different people groups that have or don't have the gospel. And this is a global map. I've just zoomed in here so we can zoom out. And we can learn about different people groups. And the red groups have fewer converts in their people group to Christianity. So that's another way of checking this. So thinking globally about the hymns we sing and where do they come from? I always think that's important to kind of know that we're part of a global church. We're not just this local thing, and we're not just the church in 2016, but it goes back in time, and it goes across geographic space. And where does our music and liturgies come from? I think that's cool. So that's what this student has tried to do here. Okay, I am going to just move quickly. This is something I always like to do for my students. I used to teach a bunch of Lutherans at Gustavus Adolphus College, and I'd show them this map, and I'd say, your world is so small and myopic. You're from here where so many people are Lutherans, but if you go anywhere else, there's not nearly as many Lutherans as there are in the upper Midwest. So we were in Minnesota, and there's a lot of these counties in Minnesota that are more than 50% Lutheran, and in North Dakota and South Dakota. But you go to Michigan, not so. Okay? So I just like to show this to kind of knock them down a little bit and say, hey, your world is very small compared to the whole world that's out there. I'd show them, look at the Baptists. They rock the South. And then I do this at Calvin, to the Calvin students. So how big, your experience of the church is how representative of even the U.S. church. You know, if you're from West Michigan, your experience is very non-representative of even the U.S. church, let alone the global church. Okay. So thinking globally. Yeah, this is the stuff I was showing you. All right. So kind of to wrap up, so we have a few minutes for questions. So whether God has put you in a church that's on an interstate highway interchange, a mega church with a 40-acre parking lot, or in a neighborhood church with nary a parking spot, or in a country church. I don't know if you get anybody from country churches like this. Whatever, God has called us to be in a particular place, to be geographical, to be God's witnesses in Jerusalem and all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. So with that, I'll take questions or comments, whatever. I'd love to hear from you.
Out of curiosity, have you ever mapped church involvement to distance?
I think that would be fascinating. I know other people have mapped where the congregational leaders live relative to the rest of the congregation. Mm-hmm. So that would, like the council, you know, and so on. Mm-hmm. But I think that would, I would love to do this. That's why I have my business card out there, because I would love to work with congregations and kind of, the things that we could do are just limitless, you know, like new members versus, or the more active members. I certainly think that distance matters because it takes time and money and, you know, and we're all busy. And so you're going to be more involved in your church if you're close by. And I'm seeing this a lot. There's a lot of young millennials who want to go to church close to home. And they don't want the baby boomers' suburban, you know, regional mega church. They want the local church. And I don't know. So I think that would be worth mapping.
More recently, I was from Portland, Oregon, where some churches actually, they have their sanctuary, but they have their offices in a separate place, like in a strip mall. And I think it's an attempt to put the church in the hub of activity, recognizing that the building, the location of the building, is an obstacle.
Yeah.
And there's more of in Portland, some of the more active churches or churches that are growing actually are eschewing owning a building, and they're going to rent. They're renting space. And so they're kind of giving up that sense of location.
We're trying to be more flexible or adaptable.
Flexible, yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Worse.
In Vancouver, Canada, land is extremely expensive. It's the most, and I lived there for 5 years, so I kind of have some experience there. It's the most expensive land in real estate in North America and actually in the English-speaking world if you correct for local incomes. And the churches have a really hard time because it's so expensive, but also the city planners know best, and they've allocated a certain amount of religious space per 10,000 residents. And so if you have enough church space or religious space, then you aren't going to get any more. So there are neighborhoods where it's all the zone space is taken, and so a new church can't do anything except buy a private market facility. So there's one church in a suburb, Burnaby, that bought a bowling alley, and they run it as a bowling alley, and then they have church on Sundays. You know, so you have to be creative. Yes.
The other thing that's interesting is how all these mapping sort of things changes over time. I've been for more than 25 years, and off the top of my head, I think we have shifted from being a neighborhood church to a commuter church. And where we used to be pretty involved with our community, now we're trying to find ways back in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there are churches, I know from experience, that have gone through cycles where they were neighborhood, commuter, metropolitan, and then neighborhood, you know, relocalized in some ways as too. So there's cycles of this. Yeah.
What, like, are there consumer level resources where we can generate these maps, or do we always have to like go to a university and find a geography professor that will work with us?
Well, I mean, I'd love to work with you, but there are. I'm trying to think. I did put on the resources some of the things that you can do. Somewhere.
It didn't jump out at me as, oh, I can go map this.
Yeah.
Like, upload my Excel.
Okay. Yeah, under the local perspectives, the U.S. address geocoder, that site and others like it, you just have a list of addresses in an Excel spreadsheet, and it will convert it to latitudes and longitudes, but you still have to be a little bit sophisticated to put latitudes and longitudes on a map. But you know, you can map, of course, things with just Google place marks and things like that. But to do more sophisticated things where you're, like, one of the churches I did had 15,000 members, you know, and you wouldn't want to do that very manually.
Exactly. We have 10,000 households, so it would be...
Yeah, but you're in L.A. There's a geography department at the University of St. Thomas, a Catholic school. They would love to do this. I know those people. You know, I mean, they would love to do this. I've had law students do this for their home church. They ask the pastor, they get permission. You strip the names off because you have to think about confidentiality in a really important ways. Because there's actually programs where if you had a map, like some of those dot maps I had, where you can actually reverse geocode that and get addresses that you could then mail to people and send political things and stuff like that. So what I do when I map is I actually offset things a certain amount so they can't get the right house. Like I introduce a thing for privacy purposes. But yeah. Yes.
This is really helpful to me, and the way that you present is very descriptive, which I appreciate. And then I'm thinking, what does all this mean? And just thinking, how do geographers work from mapping to meaning or to critical questions? So you showed some things that clearly have some power dynamics, some gentrification and racial issues or racial questions. What's the role of a geographer at that moment?
Well, I think I would have to shift over to a theologian, or kind of being speaking as a Christian or as a theologian, to like, what is this, you know, what's kind of right here? Like, I'm transitioning churches because my wife got a new job, but we have two congregations, basically a CRC congregation and a plant African American congregation, and we both are trying to do the same thing. I would love, and I might do it this summer, we're talking about it, is have both congregations do a kind of a mental map of the community that we're trying to reach and look at what. Do these maps match up? Are we experiencing the same community? Or what are the blank places on our maps that we just don't know about? And I think it might be a way of starting some really critical conversations about how we don't experience each other's worlds, or how we don't, and to learn from each other, I think.
I just so appreciated the fact that in my world, we go quickly to norms and to kind of what ought to be, and your patience to stay present to the data is helpful.
Yeah, well... Yeah, I used to think that the neighborhood church was the right way to do it, but I think that there's a place for all kinds of different sorts of churches and being faithful in different contexts. That one church that I started with that had no houses near it, The reason why is it's on a huge military Superfund site. Mm-hmm. So the land is all contaminated, so you can't build basements, you can't live there, but they were allowed to build a church there. And well, anyway, yeah. So they don't build it well, you know. They whatever. But what they do, because they have no community nearby, is they've tried to make their church a really strong place. So they have a coffee shop, and they encourage their people to spend Sunday there. You know, don't just, you know, because, or make it a neighborhood hangout. You know, they had to build a place because they didn't have a neighborhood place. Other congregations might, there was one congregation in Vancouver where the pastor prepared all the sermons at this local coffee shop and kept converting all the baristas because of the presence of that kind of dailiness and bringing people, like having his coffee breakfast with people at that particular coffee shop. That presence got those baristas interested in what was going on, and several of them converted. Just that neighborhood being the body of Christ.